All right, there we go. Hello.
Hello.
And I'm hoping, again, I don't know if I was just saying before we came on here that you need a whole AV team to keep this all straight. So I'm hoping audio is working the way it should be. I can hear you at least. That's always
That's
good.
good.
You can
I
hear
can hear you,
me?
though.
Perfect. So I guess we're good. First episode of 2024. Took a little bit of a hiatus there. Right. So, can we call this season two?
Was it? I guess so. That's the next year.
I don't think there's any rules, right? Like
I think we make
how
up the rules. Yeah.
Yeah, I think we
I think,
do. It's our show, so we make up the rules. So,
exactly.
season
Yep.
two, episode one. There you go. Mission accomplished.
Perfect.
Nobody has to know that we only did four episodes in season one, right?
Important. Limited run. Yeah.
I guess they do now if anybody's actually listening.
Well,
So
now
anyway,
it's up. Yeah.
now it's out there. It's not a secret anymore. Hey, here we go. Let's pull up. Oh, actually, give me a second here. I didn't get these. I was quickly pulling these tabs together, and I don't have the
Yeah.
tabs in the order I want. So give me
Okay.
one second here.
Let's go through. It looks like we've got a couple of security items to go through. I'm
Yeah.
going to take a look at the Stack Overflow survey.
Yeah, I'm excited
And
about that actually. I think that'd be
it's always
interesting.
interesting. Yeah, always
Yeah.
interesting to see what tech
Yeah.
people are choosing to use.
Okay. Fingers crossed. This did work earlier. There we go. All right. So, first article that I have is about RDS extended support for MySQL 5.7.
Right.
Let's see here. I think they started announced they In this article here, they announced back in September of 2023 that extended support was going to be a thing, and that if you were running, I think it applies to MySQL and Postgres, or am I getting mixed up? Is it just MySQL?
Think that there's quite a few versions of RDS runtimes that are affected
That are
by
affected?
This, yeah, so
Yeah. I think what we've seen is customers with a whole bunch of older MySQL RDS databases, right, that we've been dealing
for the
with.
most part, yep. I've
Yeah.
seen a couple Aurora ones I need updated
Okay.
too.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is all coming to a head
Yeah.
soon.
You've got what, 30 days ish?
30 days about, yep.
Yeah. Or your RDS database is going to cost you more money. Is that essentially what's going to happen, right?
Pretty much. Yeah, they're changing the support behavior. You'll get billed more, and they might even, in some cases, forcibly upgrade the minor version, depending on how old or out of date it is. So,
So if you're running MySQL 1, you're in deep trouble.
let's hope you're not running MySQL one. But.
I wonder, obviously you can't, I doubt you can run that in Amazon at this point, but I bet you could still run that on your home lab if you really wanted to.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, let me copy this. And let me see here. Again, I'm trying to remember all of the features and functions of this crazy piece of software. Let's
Oh yeah.
dump that into chat. So that if somebody wants to follow that link, I know that you've been working hard on this over the last, what, 30 days, cleaning
30
everything
days,
up. Yeah, I was just working on this with another customer earlier in the week. So yeah, lots of work to do here to avoid some additional costs and support issues, I guess. I think it's well worth your time and effort to get this done. Just make sure you properly back everything up first. Yeah.
Step
You
one,
know,
take a
yeah.
snapshot for
You
sure.
know, actually, let's talk about that a little bit. How are you approaching this? 'Cause actually, let me tell you how I did it, and
Okay.
when I was doing it, I'm like, this doesn't feel right. So, all I did, super easy. This particular situation, there was no CloudFormation templates or anything like that. It was a MySQL database that they had stood up themselves in their account. So, all I did was I created a snapshot of it. Manual snapshot so that I had it. And then I literally went into the console and said, change the version. We'll talk about the other thing that I did here in a second and apply immediately. And it did its thing. Took it maybe 5-ish minutes, let's say, and it was up and running. So no harm, no foul. When I thought about it after the fact, I was like, you know, if you had been smart, probably the better way to do it was obviously still take the snapshot. Leave the original DB instance running, create a new DB instance off of the snapshot, running MySQL 8. And then what I could have done, it was a really simple just web application that we needed to update. So I could have just worked with the web person, the app person on the phone with me and said, hey, here are the new connection strings that you're going to need. Just make that change in the app and check it. Because then, in theory, if anything had have gone sideways on us, we could have just simply changed the config and pointed it back to the original instance that was still there.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and what you're talking about is basically it's a blue-green deployment,
blue,
right?
Blue-green, yeah.
So if you wanted to be, if you had an extra sensitive production application that you want to be doubly sure that it updates properly and you don't cause any outages, then yeah, I would definitely recommend using a blue-green deploy. If you have multiple AZs on your database, that's the way to go.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're stuck with a maintenance window because updating this OS could certainly cause a restart.
Yeah, we were kind of doing this a little cowboyish, you know, nothing like just changing things in prod. So the person I was working with was like, we put it in maintenance mode, you can do whatever you want. And I was like, okay, so this is the way we'll do it. And in hindsight, as I thought of it after the fact, I'm like, you know, you could have probably done that way that would have maybe been a little safer if something had have gone wrong. We could have flipped it back a little easier, but you know, no harm, no foul in the end, so... I'll count my lucky stars.
On your application.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So this is the first one, right? If you've got older databases that will end up in extended support, you need to make sure that you've got a plan here in the next month-ish number of days to get those updated.
Clock's ticking.
I guess in theory you don't have to, but...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Might need a little bit of an increase, but...
Yeah. Yeah. And here's the second thing, and I thought this was timely as well, just because... this is something else we had to take care of. They're changing all the certs. The original cert for RDS is expiring this year,
yeah.
Right? August, I think it is.
That's right.
Yeah. Oh, right
for
here.
For the 2019.
Yeah. Yeah, sort of depends on the region that you're in that'll be affected. But we also did this. We went from RDS CA 2019 to this guy right here.
The 2048
G1, yeah. Which I think is the one that Amazon's still recommending that you use, right? In most use cases, I think.
Yeah, it helps you push out your certs to like 2060, the cert authority. So
yeah,
you won't have to modify this for a while.
So 2060, let's do the math. 36 years?
Yeah, you got a little bit of a...
Yeah, you got a little bit of a window.
Window there.
If I'm still doing this in 36 years, I'll be a really old dude by then. This beard will be severely more gray than it is right now.
That would be impressive. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if I want to do this in 30 years. I have other things that I want to do.
Hopefully you're retired somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe somewhere warmer, even though it's not really cold where we are right now. But
it's not too bad.
No.
This week, thankfully.
It should be colder than it probably is, right? This is actually I don't want to say it's easy. Obviously, there's work you need to do on the client side, right? You would obviously want to make sure you've got the certs downloaded on the clients and all of that stuff ready to go, because when you change this cert, it could affect the clients that are making those connections to your database, right?
It could, yeah. So if your client is set up to use authentication using the RDS certs, then this is definitely something you'll want to take into account when you're updating the authority on your RDS instances. You might lose connectivity, so make sure you test afterwards.
Yeah, and this is another thing we did yesterday when we made that change on the MySQL version. Did that change? Yeah. Verified, everything's good. Brought the app out of maintenance mode. Had a couple testers. Yep, everything looks good. Put it back into maintenance mode for a moment, and we went back to the console and just changed this. Good old ClickOps for the win, right? It did the trick, and we got the work done, and then the app team verified it again. So, again... went smoothly.
Yeah, it's a quick and easy change if everything goes right.
Yeah. And I know you've been doing a lot of these too recently, haven't you?
Yeah, I've been doing it in tandem with the version upgrades.
Version upgrades?
MySQL.
Yeah. So I would consider this sysadmin work still. Good old sysadmin work never really goes away, right?
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So there's that one. Let me throw this if you're getting hounded by AWS. I know I've been getting a lot of emails for a bunch of different things right now that all need a little bit of care and feeding. So I would suspect as we get closer and closer to these dates, if you're not making those changes in your environment, AWS will continue to nicely remind you that you should.
Right? You might get a few gentle nudges from the health console.
Yeah. Increasingly or less gentle as it gets closer to the, hey, just do this is what it'll eventually come down to, right?
Pretty much.
Yeah, so that's good. The next thing that was on my list is Transit Gateway Flow Logs. I know this has been around for a while, but what caught my eye here was right here. Let me zoom in a little bit. Right here in the first sentence, which we didn't talk about because we were on our... Oh, hey, Kevin. We were on our break. Let's call it a break, right? Over the holidays. Canada, U.S. U.S. What are we calling this? Is it? Is it? I don't even know what the short form for it is. CA.
Yeah.
CA, West One.
It's the Calgary region. Yeah. I guess so.
West One. Let's go West One. We'll just make it up. We're naming regions from now on. That's our new thing.
We make the rules and we name the regions.
Yeah. Exactly. So this obviously is a big deal for customers in Canada. So now you can keep. If you needed a multi-region deployment, you can keep all of your data in Canada, replicated across multiple Canadian-based regions, which is great. So that's what caught me my eye on this article is just, I didn't even realize, to be honest, that it wasn't available in the Calgary region when this came out. But transit flow logs, transit gateway flow logs are, I would say, just as important as VPC flow logs.
Yeah, it's kind of a bigger catchment area, right? So depending on how your network's set up, you can capture all of the traffic to all your very spread out VPCs. So
yeah.
You get a wider net.
Yeah. And I was thinking like here, this little statement about giving us visibility for traffic flowing across regions on the transit gateway peering, direct connect, site to site VPNs, all of these things, you can build some pretty complex networks, right? With the gateway sort of acting as the hub in that hub and spoke environment. And I know from our experience, the larger those, what I'll call transit gateway networks get, the more challenging sometimes it can be to troubleshoot when traffic isn't getting somewhere. So being able to turn this on, it's existed for a long time as far like the flow logs for, I shouldn't call them, I guess they're flow logs, right? The flow logs for the transit gateway have, that feature has existed for a long time. So just knowing that it exists and which regions you're operating in, just a bit of additional information to kind of help you troubleshoot.
Yeah, something else you can tap into and set up some monitoring for, that kind of thing. Yeah.
So that one just caught my eye, primarily because of that particular Canadian announcement, but also just because I think this is, I think a good example of a feature of a service that is really valuable, but super easy to overlook while you're setting stuff up, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Right. Like when we review accounts, how often do you find a VPC with flow logs enabled? Very rarely, actually, in my experience.
Yeah, and usually it's because they had to troubleshoot something. That's the only reason they had to set it up, right? But you should have it just for, you know, in case you want to monitor your traffic. It's good to have logs before you need them, right?
Collect those logs before you need them. And even here, right, it may, depending on your compliance requirements, may help you with your compliance, meeting your compliance requirements. And definitely we use it for security monitoring all the time, but it's really important for troubleshooting. So an interesting feature that if you're building transit gateway networks or networks using transit gateways, something that you might want to look at.
Yeah.
And this one caught my eye as well. A little too much zoomed in. So Inspector, and I, you know what? I wanted to dig into this one a little more before we got running today. And I just, I was saying to you earlier today, I don't know, January, I can't believe that it's gone already. And today I'm like, how is it Friday already? It's like I'm having like lost time moments this week. I'm like, no, can't be. So anyways, I didn't get a chance to look into this, but for those that don't know, Inspector is a service that helps you run automated vulnerability assessments within your AWS account. It supports way more than EC2. You can see here, actually, they've got a list here, right? So you've got EC2, ECR-based workloads,
your containers,
Lambda functions, containers. So it's a
most
really
compute solutions.
Yeah, yeah, it's one of those services that there's a cost to it. So obviously everything, you know, you got to make sure it fits in your budget. I would say though, like if you're building compute workloads, I don't know what you think, but this would be kind of one of those things that I think it would make a lot of sense to have turned on.
Yeah. Well, especially if you're running in production and you have a publicly exposed application, you definitely want to have some kind of monitoring for, you know, intrusion or vulnerabilities. And this is, it's a solid solution for that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know what? This is, I guess, version two of the Inspector. Inspector used to be, my recollection is Inspector used to be an agent-based solution. You had to go out and install those agents.
Oh, right.
And as far as I know, and I don't know if you need an agent for this new feature. I would suspect you probably don't. But as far as I know now, it's completely agentless and it supports organizations. Yeah. So you can just turn it on for everything within your AWS organization. So enable it on all your member accounts.
Yeah, that's handy. I'm kind of wondering if they must just be able to scan the machines from like externally. Yeah, they must just have tooling to do that.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure under the hood how it works. I think, you know, I was thinking we're going to bring back the, now that we're kind of off of the hiatus, next Tuesday we'll bring back the Twitch streaming on Tuesday evenings. Maybe this is one of the things we could do. Set up Inspector the first time and just check out this new feature. Just interesting to see how it works.
For sure.
Perfect. So that's that one. I'm gonna come back to the Stack Overflow thing in a minute.
Oh, yeah.
But here we go. Step functions. Okay, so let me say this first. Step functions is always something that I've been interested in.
Mm-hmm.
But outside of a few little projects that we've worked on, we use step functions in our on our own website and stuff like that. I haven't actually seen, at least in the work that we're doing, any of our customers use step functions.
No.
No. It's, yeah, it's what always catches my eye about this is they continue to add more and more integration into other services, including Queue now. I don't know what that integration is, but the thing that has always kind of been really interesting to me about this is when step functions first came out, it was just, it helped you kind of orchestrate your workflows, right? It gave you a nice GUI you could use. I think they called it, and they probably still do, Amazon State Language, which was just a JSON document, right? That helped you sort of build out your workflow. And then you could visualize that workflow. But you still just, let's be honest, you still ended up invoking a whole bunch of Lambda functions. But now you had a way to kind of visualize how all those Lambda functions talk to each other, and there's obviously lots of logic there, right? Like branching and all that great stuff. But one of the things that's always really been interesting to me about step functions and what they're doing with this product is this integration. So what you can do now is avoid those kind of Lambda functions that act as glue. So you're not invoking a Lambda function to put an item in a DynamoDB table in your step function. You just simply say, I want you to run for me a put item API call, and you give it the structure and it makes the calls for you, assuming that you've given the step function the permissions to do that.
Direct to the service, yeah.
Yeah, so like to me, it almost seems like, and correct me if I'm wrong here, maybe I'm thinking about this the wrong way. It's not a no-code situation, but it's... No. Increasingly, I think about it as a low-code situation. Like, don't write the Lambda function. Just write the JSON document that maps the input to output that you're going to dump into your DynamoDB table.
Pretty much, yeah.
Right? So I'm not writing Python code anymore. I'm just writing a JSON doc.
Yeah, and for the workflows that they see them demo it for, it's mostly for kind of specific chain workflows, like ordering something. For example, like the ordering a coffee, you'll place your order and then you'll say provide payment. And then if there's capacity, they'll build it, et cetera. Or it'll go through the order chain. That's mostly the use case I see it for, but I haven't seen any of our customers. Yeah.
Yeah. Use it. I'm always impressed by the step functions team and just how they, you can kind of, it's like I call it crystal ball gazing. Like, you can kind of get their thought process by watching these announcements. And I would say ultimately the idea here is to remove as much of that sort of, I don't want to use the term glue, but because that might confuse somebody, I'm thinking about AWS glue, but I'm not. Like, I often think about glue as Lambda functions as the glue, right? It's the way that you kind of glue two things together. And really what you're doing here with all of these direct service integrations with step functions is step functions and that direct integration is the glue. Avoid the Lambda function altogether.
And then plug in the services you need, like building blocks, right?
Yeah. This might be another good thing we could add to our Tuesday night series, right? Like, build out a simple workflow using step functions and as best we can avoid Lambda functions and just try to figure out the direct integration piece.
Yeah, it's not a bad idea. Just see if you can.
Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, see if you can simulate like ordering a thing or something like that.
Yeah. And what the heck can you do with queue? Like, in your workflow, like, this is the part that I wish I could go back in time in an hour or two and get the time just to fill this blank in. But like, what can you ask queue a question as part of your workflow?
I don't know.
Like,
I'm wondering, like, can you tell it to, what service, write the thing to connect to the service kind of thing?
Yeah. I don't know. We'll have to mess around with that a little bit and see how it works.
It's worth a stream. Yeah,
it's worth a stream, right? So there's that one. And then finally, the 2003? I forgot what year it was. 2003. See? I just went back in time.
You are in time.
Yeah, I'm in the total loss of time moments. 2023. There we go. Developer survey from Stack Overflow, which is always interesting to see what people are thinking about. And you've here 90,000 developers responded to this survey. There's lots of really interesting information in here. So if we click through a few of these tabs, what you can do is just kind of scroll down and have a look at, most popular scripting languages, databases, cloud platforms. This one's interesting that 49 if we round up instead of down, 49% of the respondents said that they are using the AWS platform. And then you've got Azure and Google Cloud there behind them. What's that?
Yeah.
Somebody do the math. About 49% between the two of them. So that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, I think these are spread out, like multiple people. You can submit multiple answers too.
I'm sure there's a little tomfoolery happening in some of these things, right? Take everything with a bit of a grain of salt, but it's still a pretty interesting.
It's pretty telling, right? Like, AWS still has the biggest market share, which I mean, makes sense. They have the most service coverage, right? What's in the professional developers tab?
Yeah, so I went to the professional developers tab, and the number is higher. All respondents versus professional developers. Now, do they tell us what a professional developer is? Were you talking about this tab down here?
I think so. I don't have real time view of your.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, of course not. I'm like looking at my screen, going, "You can't see it." Let's go up to developer profile. Do they define for us what they consider to be a professional developer? I'm sure they do somewhere in here.
They must, right?
Yeah.
I think it's probably just someone who says they have a job as a developer.
Yeah, maybe, right? The one thing that I also thought was interesting in here, there's a learning to code. And I think you could take from that what you would, I kind of think about it as just learning technology in general, right? Forget the code piece.
Yep.
But I thought it was kind of interesting. What is it? 80% of all respondents said that they are learning how to code with other online resources, videos, blogs, and forums.
Yep.
80%.
Yeah, it's mostly video now for the most part.
Yeah, I didn't think that number would be that high. I don't know why. For whatever reason in my brain, I thought that school sort of like, I don't want to call it professional instruction. That's not fair. But you know what I mean? Like structured learning environments where you're right. sort of required to show up at to a class every day, I guess, if you think about it that way. It's only 50%. It's only 50%.
Yeah.
Books and physical media are better than school.
Yeah. Which is interesting. But I mean, it's the kind of field that you can pick up a resource like that and apply it pretty much immediately, right?
Yeah.
So if you have the wherewithal, you can go and find whatever you want on YouTube.
Yeah, YouTube.
Or on
Learn
blogs,
everything
right?
you need to know from YouTube.
There's a huge culture of developers writing blogs about their work. So
That's and all I fall 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I fall on the fifth part of this on the job training.
Mm. Mm.
Go figure this out.
There's a lot of that. Yeah.
Yeah. You want me to do what? Okay. So let's go. And I guess from on the job training, most times that leads to other online resources.
It does redirect there. Yeah.
Yeah. So those two are probably tied quite tightly together, right? How do I do this? Google search.
Yeah. Definitely complement each other.
Although we're going to talk about something in a minute that probably changes your Google search. Most popular technologies. Let's go into there's a whole section for AI. And I thought this was interesting. Okay, so let's see. AI tools and your development process. About 44% said they're using tools in their development process right now.
Yep.
The sentiment towards the tools, let's say 28% were favorable, 49% were, or sorry, 28% were very favorable. It's a hard word to say. Yep. Excuse me. And 49% were favorable. So that, I'm not going to try to do the math because I'm having some challenges in my brain today. That's a lot of people, right? So a lot of people are feeling pretty good about using tools in their regular day-to-day job. On the developer tool side, most people are saying the biggest benefit is productivity and speeding up learning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I believe it. I mean, that's one of the main benefits of these tools is you could go and ask a question and get a natural language answer. That is, it's usually pretty good, right?
The way I think about it, it's kind of close. It'll get you like 3/4 of the way there. And it's probably not exactly what you want. But then I think the real skill of this is, do they call it prompt engineering? Is that the fancy term for this? Like, how do you frame your questions and your follow-up questions in the appropriate way to get the answer that you actually need? I think that that's probably going to be a pretty huge skill in the future.
Yeah, how to refine your queries to get it to do what you need it to do. Yeah, yeah, that's going to be key for this.
How do you talk to the machine?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I bet you like a lot of the people who are saying that they're not trusting it are using the code generation part though.
Yeah, that actually is a good segue because the next section that I was looking at here is accuracy of tools. So about 3% of the respondents say they highly trust it. Let's say 5, if we were going to round up, we're going to say 6% highly distrust.
Yeah, and I think that's probably where you should be landing either on highly distrust or somewhat distrust, because these things still hallucinate. They can't read your mind, right?
Yeah. So and plus, you know what, it's no different than talking to another human. If you ask a shitty question, you're gonna get a shitty answer. Right. So that goes back to that idea of prompt engineering, or you know, how do you talk to the machine to get it to tell you what you're actually after, right? To your point, it's not going to read your mind, not yet.
What it's really good for, like it's really great at, is generating, talking specifically about tools like Copilot and Code Whisper, is generating boilerplate for projects.
Yeah.
Like setting up your files in a way that is good enough to get you started and build out the actual logic that you want to implement. And it can be okay for the complex, more complex things, but you'll find as you go through, there's some bugs in there. There's areas it makes mistakes, right? So.
Yeah. I would put myself in the somewhat trust. I can tell you that I am using Code Whisper and Q every single day. When I'm in my IDE, I'm asking it questions. I'm asking Q questions. Code Whisperer is doing its best to try to read my mind. And in some cases, it's kind of scary. How it's like, the thing that's really impressed me about this is how you, as you're typing, you're writing out something, and it's trying to take from what you, it appears at least, right? That it's trying to take maybe variables that you're setting or parameters that you're passing in earlier in the script and pulling it into whatever you're writing further down. I think it's pretty impressive.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask you, it's been about 2 months since it's generally available, and for Code Whisperer in ID and Amazon Q in ID, is it... So I guess it is working out for you then. Like,
it's, I would say it's so.
It's worth using,
I would say so. You know what? Like, we're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit because we wanted to wrap up with Q, but we're kind of getting close to the end. I know that when Q was announced, you know, shitposting is the thing that gets you the most... engagement. So there was lots of that happening. Yeah. I can tell you it's a part of my daily workflow. Here's the way I think about it. Okay. So I'm in the IDE, right? If we scroll back in the benefits of tools, right? This idea of increasing productivity, speeding up learning, better improving your efficiency, all those things. If I can stay in my IDE and I just have Q open on the right-hand side, right? And I can ask a question in there versus having to open up a browser, go to my favorite search engine or whatever it is and ask the question there. For me, just being able to ask the specific question to Q right in the IDE, that's a huge benefit for me immediately. I don't know. Maybe it's just me, but I'm like, I'm not having to switch context. You know what I mean? I'm not having to jump between multiple things. I think that's huge. Right away. You and I've had you and I've had some funny exchanges of screenshots on some of the stuff that we got back from Q.
Yeah.
So that goes to what we were talking about, the accuracy and trusting it, but it's only going to get better, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty neat. So here, I'll put the Stack Overflow thing in chat. I'll go back to the overview and we'll just, that way everybody can start from right there. I like Kevin's comment in chat. Explain all the AWS concepts. Now explain it to me like I'm five.
Yep.
Yeah. Prompt engineering 101, right?
It's just, just that easy.
Yeah. So that pretty much wraps up season 2, episode 1.
Season 2,
There we go. We were renewed for another season.
That's right. Not canceled.
Yeah, not canceled. Not yet. No. We'll see how far we make it in season 2. Let's before we wrap up, let's spend just a few more minutes talking a little bit more about Q in Code Whisperer. Were there anything other thoughts that you had on it? You know what? Actually, before we do that, there was a section, developer tools. Where was it? I won't be able to find it now that I want it. But like, where are they? Well, I'll let somebody else find it in the chat. By leaps and bounds, is it Copilot? Is kind of,
it's product. I would guess it's Copilot. Yeah.
Yeah. Like it's like miles and miles ahead of everybody else as far as the tools that people are using for this. I can't even remember. I wish I could find it now. I can't even remember if Code Whisperer was on the list. Professional developer tools, accuracy.
Oh, yeah, I'm interested to see it. I've noticed I definitely prefer using Copilot to Whisperer for code generation.
Yeah.
For Python, if I need to do any, like the suggestions I think are better. For CloudFormation though, like you said, I think Code Whisperer is better. Yeah.
Yeah. I've been amazed multiple times using it, thinking to myself, like, how the heck is it doing this? And like, even to the point where, like it's pulling in, the way I like to set my tags up and stuff. Like I generally, you know this, right? We generally use a common set of tags as a starting point for everything. And as I'm writing out these templates, it's just pulling in, hey, here, I know this is probably what you're going to want. And it's dumping those in as the tags. I, I think it's pretty amazing. The one thing that I would say about both Q and Code Whisper that's really annoying is how often it logs you out.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
The token doesn't, it lasts for like an hour.
An hour, right? So I wonder if there's a way you can change that. Maybe there's a setting somewhere, but that seems annoying. But I guess if it's that's the biggest thing you could complain about, you're in pretty good shape.
Do we know how, Kevin's asking, do we know how long Q's in preview for? That's a good question.
Good question. I don't know. I just got something, another friendly reminder from AWS today about Q preview. What the heck was it talking about? I think they were talking about the terms of service. They were changing some of the language in it. And they were also, the way I read it was they were also reaffirming sort of what happens to your data. Is it used for training? Because there's Code Whisperer Professional, there's Q, and I guess there's going to be Q Business at some point when it comes out of preview.
Yeah.
I don't know what the pricing model is for Q, and I'm not quite sure how long Q is going to be in preview mode. Oh, Kevin, you did see the pricing breakdown for Q, eh? Is that Q or Code Whisperer that you saw? We'll see if Kevin gives us a response.
Yeah. Yeah, it's... it's interesting. Yeah, I'm sure they'll keep it in preview for until they're ready to roll that out. And then...
Yeah. Well, we pay for Code Whisperer Pro or whatever they call it. I signed up for that immediately. I think it's, I really enjoy it. Now, I don't have anything to compare it to because I haven't used, is it called Copilot?
Yeah,
I haven't used Copilot, so I don't really have a comparison between the two. But you're saying that you prefer Copilot for code generation and stuff?
Yeah, for now. The suggestions just, I think they're better.
But. They're better? Yeah. Perfect. I'm letting Kevin type. He's madly searching for something for us. I know he's pulling up some info right now. So we'll give him a couple minutes here to finish his thought. While we're waiting, anything else on the sort of AI end of things since we're talking about Q? Oh, sorry, can't send the link. I was talking about Q differences. Yeah, maybe what we'll do is we'll pull that together and we'll make sure for the next stream we'll get that info.
Yeah, business is like $20 per user per month.
So it's exactly the same as Code Whisperer then. I think Code Whisperer was like $19 or something.
That seems to be the sweet spot for these services. They're all pricing at about the same.
Yeah. No. So that's not too bad. I think for us and what we do, when it comes out of preview, I will subscribe to it for the org and add us as users and just see see what it does. You know, the one thing, and maybe it's there, is usage information. It would be really good to be able to know how much is Code Whisperer, the pro level of Code Whisperer, how much are we actually using it? Like, are they getting, how many queries a day are we generating? Because if you are paying $20 per user per month, you would want people to be engaged, right? And using it.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, that gets us to, about 45 minutes. Not bad for season 2, episode 1. We will be back next Friday. Where we wrap up the week again with some interesting announcements. And don't forget, Tuesday night, we'll be back 7 p.m. on Twitch, the regular Curious Orbit Twitch channel. And I will pull something out of what we talked about today. And we'll write some code and flounder about and try to figure some stuff out. You never know what's going to happen.
All right.
Awesome.
You never know.
Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next week. Bye for now.